The Speaker of the Nova Scotia House of Assembly grants permission to record the televised proceedings of the legislature for use in schools and for other purposes, such as private study, research, review, or newspaper summary. Television and radio broadcasters may make use of recorded excerpts of the televised proceedings in their news or public affairs programs for the purpose of fair and accurate reports of proceedings. Program material may not be used for political party advertising, election campaigns, or any other politically partisan activity. Program material may not be edited for use in promotional material by any political party or other organization, and may not be used in any edited form that could mislead or misinform an audience or viewer, or which does not present a balanced portrayal of the proceedings in the House. Video program material may only be used with its original audio components, and no other audio material may be added to video material used. Any other commercial use or rebroadcast of these proceedings requires the express written approval of the Speaker.
Good morning, everyone. It's 9 o'clock now, and I'd like to call the meeting of the Public Accounts Committee to order. This morning, our agenda shows that we'll be hearing from the Office of the Auditor General, and we're visited today again with the auditor and the assistant auditors to go over the most recent Auditor General's report. And before we begin that, I'd like to have the members of the committee introduce themselves. So if we could begin with Mr. Morton.
Good morning. Jim Morton, MLA Kings North.
Matt Wynott, Hammonds Plains, Upper Sackville.
Good morning. Clary McKinnon, MLA Pictou East.
Good morning and welcome. Howard Epstein, MLA for Halifax, Chibucto.
Morning. Keith Caldwell, MLA for Preston.
Good morning. Alan McMaster, MLA for Inverness.
Good morning, Chuck Porter, MLA for Hants West.
Good morning, Diana Whalen, MLA for Clayton Park, and also the chair of the Public Accounts Committee. And perhaps we'll go just to our support staff here, too.
Darlene Henry, committee clerk.
Thank you very much. With that, I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Lapointe, and you can introduce the auditors with you and begin with your presentation. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, my fall report was tabled with the House of Assembly last week. It was my second report in 2011 and covered audits completed by my office during the summer and fall of this year, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to discuss it with you today. With me today are Deputy Auditor General Alan Horgan on my left and Assistant Auditors General Terry Spicer and Evangeline Coleman-Saad on my right. They were each responsible for certain chapters in the report, and I'm sure that among us we can answer any questions that you may have. Before we begin, I do want to acknowledge the valuable work, dedication, and professionalism of all my staff, whose efforts made it possible for us to provide assurance to the House of Assembly on the operations of government. I also thank the many public servants in departments and agencies whose understanding and cooperation were vital to the success of our audits. There are five audits included in the report, covering a range of government activities, and we make 43 recommendations in total to improve departmental and agency operations. I will just briefly mention the topics covered. We examined the government's ability to recover from a disaster affecting its computer data center. We found the financial systems are well prepared for a major interruption. However, the various non-financial systems supported by the Office of the Chief Information Officer are potentially at risk. The CIO needs to develop and implement a disaster recovery plan. We found the Department of Agriculture's meat inspection program to be deficient in inspections, or rather, audits of slaughterhouses and meat processing plants. We recommended significant improvements to reduce public health risks associated with meat sold in the province. On a more positive note, the Departments of Health and Welfare and Community Services are doing a good job of investigating and ensuring resolution of allegations of abuse in residential care facilities. We did recommend some improvements, including an appeal process. The government has also done a good job acting on the recommendations of the Nunn Commission of Inquiry dealing with youth justice systems. Almost all Justice Nunn's recommendations have been acted upon. The most significant remaining gap involves the recommendation for a bail supervision program, and we recommend that this gap be addressed. Finally, we reported that we were unable to audit the operations of the Canada-Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. The board required an undertaking from us that any information provided by the two operators, that's ExxonMobil and Encana, that is not already public, would not be disclosed in our audit report without the permission of the operators. We would not provide that undertaking, and the board, on instruction from the operators, refused us access to the information we needed to conduct the audit. We are therefore unable to provide assurance to the House as to whether the board is meeting its regulatory responsibilities. We cannot provide an opinion as to whether the public interest is being protected. And with that, Madam Chair, it will be our pleasure to answer any questions that you may have on our report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lapointe. And with that, I should note we've been joined by Mr. Scobar as well, so we have all members present. And I'd like to turn the floor over to Mr. Caldwell, and you have 20 minutes for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank the Auditor General for the thorough report, like always, that you and your staff do, and it's greatly appreciated by everyone. And it's nice to hear, too, that in your report that there's some positive things happening in some departments. That's always good to hear as well. It says a lot for the staff and that work with government. I thank you for that. The one thing that, several things that concern me greatly is the fact that you weren't able to properly audit the Canada-Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. Now, we've asked questions in the House of the Minister of Energy, and unfortunately the Minister of Finance answered for him. But how serious is this? I know we went through this before the audit. The act was changed by the present government and supported by all parties to give your office more authority. Does the act have to be changed again or amended to properly give you the authority you need?
Thank you. The recommendation we made was that the government sit and examine the entire legislative framework around this, and that probably means the core of this is the two Accord Acts, federal and provincial. I think that's where the focus of any review should be. And it's probably time to reconsider the contents of those acts to clarify the whole issue of privilege and access to audit.
And there's been some suggestion by the government that this is easy to fix, you just go to court. I had never seen any time you've ever gone to court anything easy to fix. But what's your feeling on that? Is you would know it better probably than anyone else.
Yes, I know that the recommendation or suggestion has been made that we resolve this in the courts, and I guess I've come out saying that I disagree with this, and I do. I think that there are different options that can be undertaken in the courts on this, including to some extent that section of the Act 14.6, the Auditor General Act, a dispute resolution mechanism, what our discussion has been about. My feeling is that isn't really applicable. It can't resolve the issues at stake. There are other ways that we could approach this, and we've looked at these things, and are still open to considering them. But I do not feel still that any of the possible legal avenues or court avenues are really effective and would resolve the issues here and actually provide the freedom to not only to access, but to report that we require.
Do you think the proper way to address them would be to amend the Act again to cover this, or what's, from your standpoint, what would fix this permanently? Because that's really what we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
There are possibly different ways of approaching it, and I wouldn't want to sit down and say right now, here is a definitive approach, make this change to this Act, and that will resolve it. Because there might be different ways to do it. I don't know if simply changing the Auditor General Act to deal with the situation would be effective, because this is a more slightly more complex issue. We've recommended, in fact, the board itself has agreed with our recommendation in writing, and they feel that the Accord Acts need to be reconsidered and changed. And certainly changing the Accord Acts would resolve the issue.
Does that require federal and provincial cooperation with that, or is that just strictly provincial?
I suspect that being two acts which are identical and part of an agreement with the federal government, that this would require some consultations with the federal government. But again, I think that needs to be, to what extent, I can't really say. But I suspect it would need some discussion with them too, yes.
That's something that the government would have to initiate and with their federal counterparts and move that forward if they decided to do that.
That's correct.
What is the exact, or close as you can be to exact, issue, the real issue with the companies? Is it proprietary information you're afraid that you're going to release with the audit, or?
It's not possible for me to say what, you know, their exact concerns are about the information. I know that they were sticking with the letter of the Act, in the Accord Act, which states that all information they provide to the board of any kind is privileged and requires their approval to disclose to anyone else. And so that is what they stayed with. And that is what the Accord Act states, and that is one of the reasons we feel, and the board, in fact, feels that the Accord Act needs to be reexamined, because that's a very, very broad provision. Any piece of information that can be tied to the operators becomes privileged according to their act. So on the basis of that, they refuse to provide us access to that information. We don't know what it all is, of course. It's a kind of a, because we haven't seen it.
And this, of course, this information would be the information that they would have the Canadian Offshore Petroleum Board, and it would be all part of the negotiations and the deals that they would have with them. That would be the information regarding that, I would think. Would that be correct?
It could be any information in the files. You know, it's defined as anything received from the board. So, in fact, an email, an innocuous email talking about setting up a meeting would be privileged. Any kind of documentation, any report that they made to the board on their operations to comply with the board's policies, pretty well anything that came from operators to the board of any form is covered by that.
Yeah, sounds something like when we were trying to get information before from cabinet documents that came all blacked out. I have a long memory of that, and that was quite an interesting operation. As a result of that, your act was amended as it should have been. I'm going to change now to the meat inspection program. You went through that in pretty good detail, well, always in very good detail, actually. And it was some pretty interesting information you come up with, and it really didn't identify. One thing that really concerned me of the whole thing is, I'm sort of talking in circles here this morning, but the one thing that really disturbed me was there was no way to know if there was any incidences of food poisoning or any other problem that there, because basically, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that if someone gets food poisoning, it could be from meat, they go to the hospital and it's there, and is maybe no system in place for the inspection department to find out about that. I don't know. Would that be an accurate assumption, or am I all wrong with that?
No, I'd say that's an accurate depiction of it. The number of cases that you could estimate of food poisoning of all kinds, from meat or anything else, in a province or across the country, in fact, is really very high. And most of it is quite minor, but it's still food poisoning of one kind or another. And there's no process in place nationally or provincially to to gather all this information. Most people, you know, just get ill, stay home, and come in the next day. That's food poisoning. And so I'm not aware of any statistics that would let us have any kind of an idea of the full extent of it here or elsewhere, and certainly not the extent that can be tied to any one food source like meat.
The question would be then, is that's why your audit was so important, because if everything is inspected properly, documented properly, and proven that there's not a problem, at least at that stage in the processing until it gets to the grocery stores, at least we can have confidence that that part of the operation is safe and as safe as it should be. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, the concern we have with the process that we were inspecting or that we were auditing was to ensure that there is to see whether there's a very solid process in place I'd characterize it as minimizing the risk of food poisoning from these sources. You can't eliminate risk completely from any kind of food source. It's very difficult, as we found, you know, in other places in this country. Things happen no matter how hard you try. But the program of meat inspection, if it's rigorously applied and done well, would reduce the risk as much as is possible to reduce it. And that's really what we wanted to see, whether that was happening.
Basically, what your report said or really pointed to, there's no quality assurance system at all for the meat inspection. Would that be correct?
That's correct. There is not.
Yeah, that's very troubling because for several reasons. Number one, a quality assurance system, which I did operate for a long time, a very, very stringent one, really does look after any kind of problem. I mean, it really does, and I'm disappointed to see there isn't a quality assurance system in place through the department in this regard, and probably with all the stuff they do. Is there any indication the department is going to put a quality assurance system in place to ensure that these things are done and documented properly?
They have responded positively to our recommendations, and have indicated to us that they intend to deal with the recommendations and implement them. I think that our recommendations on this are pretty comprehensive, and dealing with, I should stress that we're dealing with the inspection and audit of the facilities, the plants themselves. We did conclude that the inspection of the actual slaughtering process is actually very well handled, and we had very little to say about that. But it's the inspection and audit of facilities that we're commenting on.
Yeah. In other words, there's part of it done very well, and the rest of it really needs some improvement.
That's correct.
But an overall quality assurance system would cover everything anyway. So if they had that in place, that would resolve all these problems. Is that correct?
It would resolve it would deal with the monitoring and supervision of the process that's happening in the field, and so I mean there are other aspects to this that need to be put in place, as we've indicated in the recommendations, such as, you know, better enforcement tools like tickets and fines, but a quality assurance process would be a way to make sure that management is on top of the quality and quantity of the work being done in the field.
Yes, because every quality assurance system I've ever been involved in is from the top. In this case, it'd be from the minister right through the whole system.
Yeah.
And the ones that I've been associated with, it would be in a business, it always is to the owner or the president of the company, the quality assurance people report, not to a director, not to a manager, not to a deputy minister, but to the person at the top of the ladder, so they can feel free if they have a problem to identify it and bring it forward without a chance of retribution from anyone in the system that may not be doing their part of the process. Hopefully that will happen someday as we go forward. But overall, and it's always we want to make sure we have safe food, and especially here in Nova Scotia, because we want to support more and more local businesses here, farms and everything else. But you indicated that there really didn't be, or maybe I should ask you the question. Let me ask you the question. Do you feel there's a real risk from any kind of problems with this because of this process, or something that just has to be tidied up in the department to make sure there's no risk? That's sort of a loaded question, but...
Mr. Spicer?
Yes, I'll ask Mr. Spicer to talk more specifically about that.
That is kind of a difficult question to answer, but I mean, I guess the best way to answer it would be that any type of controls that any organization put them in place to mitigate certain risks. In this particular case, the facility audit process is not working like it should be. So because of that, it's not as effective in mitigating the risks associated with contamination of meat once it starts processing. So from that perspective, it isn't being as effective as it should be.
Yes, and that is troublesome, of course, because if you have a total quality assurance system in place, it looks at all those things, and it's all one factor. And it all goes together. And the thing about a quality assurance system is a lot of times the quality inspector that comes from outside a company is always looked at, oh, no, he's back again attitude. And sometimes it's rightfully so, he's back and he should be back and maybe there's problems. But if it's done properly and very clearly laid out exactly what the standards are supposed to be, then they're glad to see them come because it's just a check of what they've done and prove that they did it right. And 99% of the time, once that system's in place, there's very, very few defaults. Has there been recommendations? And I went through your recommendations, but I just wanted on the record to do just that. So there's very clear objectives for the quality insurance, the process to make sure it has a quality assurance system that follows through and is backed up and traceable. And also on the end of the supplier that they're very clear what those requirements are.
Mr. LaPointe?
The recommendations dealing with the quality assurance have left it to the department to design it appropriately. But we had in mind a fairly rigorous quality assurance process that would cover the whole system. Now, it does require, however, in spite of that, that, as I mentioned, that some other changes be done besides that. In dealing with, for instance, ensuring that there's some better direction and control of simply the number of audits that are done, that there's a policy for how often a plant should be looked at, and that they are in fact done that often, that enforcement is strengthened. So it requires a fairly broad scope of changes to resolve the issues in this program, and I don't feel that any of them are excessively onerous, and it can all be done. I would expect that fairly quick action could be taken on this one.
Well, that is very positive, and I'm sure that the department will. I mean, I think we have very good people working in our civil service and very dedicated to the jobs they do, and sometimes they don't receive sometimes the direction or haven't had the opportunity to do or the support they've needed to do their work in some cases. And I'm not saying that's the case here, but it is troubling, and it is it's something that I'm glad to see that your department did audit and that it's being addressed by government. And you're confident they're addressing this rapidly?
Pardon me?
Are you confident they're going to address this quite quickly?
They have indicated a support for the recommendations, yes. And so I have no reason to doubt that they will act on it.
Yes, that's very positive. I'm sure they will. We just wouldn't want to see somebody get sick that could be traced back. And I know you said in your report that that's never been shown to be the case. But again, once somebody realizes there might be a flaw in it, there might be all of a sudden some issues that arise. How much time do I have left?
A minute and a half.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the disaster preparedness system, but I don't have enough time to do that. I'll hold that to my second round of questioning.
I think I'll stop at this point.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. And will it be Mr. Porter? Okay, for the Conservative Caucus, and you have 20 minutes now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to yourself, Mr. LaPointe, and your staff for compiling the audit and the facts that we found within, and, of course, making the recommendation as to where you think we need to go. I've got a couple topics I want to cover as well, and I will start with the disaster preparedness stuff. It's been interesting because I'm not sure that there was a lot of clarity around this whole piece. Some would have believed that we were fairly well set up, but I'm not sure that that's what your report represents. I know maybe in some areas of disaster preparedness, more so than in others, we are better served. I know locally in my own area in Hants West, there's a fabulous setup there. There's a REMO that works together by way of the three municipal units. There's an organization, a whole facility set up in the base of the Hantsport Town Council Chambers. And it's, you know, the latest technology. It's everything. There's spots for everyone to work. It's very, very well done. I know from my previous employment at the Provincial Ambulance Communication Center that there's a backup site that is also very high tech. It's probably 15 minutes away from our everyday location. It's up and running in minutes. There's a whole plan in place, much planning, hours, days, months, years of planning went into that actually and making that all happen. So I wonder if you can just sort of speak to where the issues are within disaster preparedness so that the public is more clear, or maybe some of us who formerly worked in that sort of thing are more clear as to what you find wrong and where we need to go.
Yes, I'll say, make a couple of comments, and then I can certainly ask Alan Horgan to provide you with more depth on it. But and the overview is that we were looking at the data center in which stores the main computer servers and is sort of the central hub of government computer systems. And the concern we have with the security of that center and the risk that things can happen to it, everything from fire to flood, as we know, which damages the computers and then has an impact on all the operations of all computer systems in government. So what we were looking at was whether, if something happened there, given the centralization of these systems, what's in place to recover quickly. And that is where we found differences in the ability to recover. And, you know, the positive news was this was that there are different groups operating different, I guess, sets of systems in here. The financial systems managed by the Department of Finance were overall in good shape in terms of recovery from a disaster. And we mentioned a number of things, like a secondary site they have and a good disaster recovery plan. And we recommended a few improvements to that. But the concern that we found was with the systems managed by the CIO, which is all the non-financial systems of government, that had limitations in their ability to recover for a number of reasons. And that is where our concern was. I think Alan can... That's a fairly high level of what we're looking at, but I think Alan could tell you a little more detail of what the problem was.
Mr. Horgan?
Certainly. What we found when we audited the operations supported by the CIO were things like the lack of an up-to-date disaster recovery plan, an actual document that brings it all together and says what should be done if any kind of major crisis were to occur.
Sorry to interrupt, Alan. Is that also the backup of the current data and all of those things? Is that all part of that, or is there something separate from that?
It is a bit of both. A disaster recovery plan should indicate how to get the data that you've already backed up.
Yeah.
Up and running again. And it's very important to have as much information in the disaster recovery plan so that people can kind of follow it step by step, especially if the people who might be knowledgeable on how to run these processes are not available after a disaster. It would be good to have all, you know, these checklists that says, you know, whoever's available, this is how you bring this data up and running. But still, as you mentioned, it's extremely important also to have systems that that do the backups. They have to be done regularly, and the backups have to be held off-site so that any crisis that hits the data center will not impact the data as well.
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with that. That's why I asked that question. And it is a matter of being back up in some departments, I would think, immediately, given that we do so much stuff online these days and make services available and so on, and access to government. But yeah, that backup system was what I was more curious about, is how much of that plays a part in this. It sounds like it's all one and the same. Are we backed up daily on the systems here in the province of Nova Scotia, or how does that work?
I believe there is daily backups. It's a phase kind of backup where, perhaps daily they're just backing up major changes.
Yeah.
And then on a regular basis, maybe weekly or some other period, there will be total backups. There's different kinds or different levels of backup, and all that backup is sent to another location.
Right. So are we finding that the backup stuff is being stored on the same site and not being moved as it should be moved to a backup site that is ready to go within a number of minutes or hours, what have you? In this particular case, is that what we're seeing as one of the deficiencies, or is it more than that?
It's a little bit more than that. We have no concern about where the data is being stored. It is being sent to another location.
Okay.
Now, the other location is, around 3 kilometers away from the data center. So there is that maybe a little bit of a concern that if a disaster is large enough, it may impact the data center and this other place that holds the data. But for, most kind of crisis incidents, the backup data probably would survive. So we had no concern about where it's kept.
And the backup location, it's all generated, powered, set up, ready to go regardless
yes.
of those issues?
That was the other part of it.
Yeah.
No, that is not the case. There is no secondary processing site that would be sufficient to bring up all the critical systems that the data center runs. So the data is off-site, but there are not great amounts of computer servers available to load that data onto if the data center becomes impacted by a disaster.
And no way to access it anyway if you're not backed up by way of a secondary source of power, i.e. a generator, 3 kilometers apart is probably, I can see your concern in that. You probably want to be a little farther than that apart, mm-hmm. I guess, all things being good.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it's sometimes difficult to do, but that's interesting. Thank you for that. And so there's been some recommendations obviously made going forward, and I'm going to assume that the department is fine with that. They're willing to work. And have you had any indication that they feel that they're strongly satisfactory the way they are, or do you think? I know that the worst part is in government and economic tough times and things and such. We appreciate that it's always about the God Almighty dollar and what needs to be spent. But these recommendations, I would suggest, are not to be taken lightly. So. Mm-hmm. You have the cooperation from that department. I'm going to assume that these are going to get done in a timely manner. Or?
That's correct. They were very receptive to our findings and our recommendations. And I must say they were very cooperative and very helpful in the audit as well. The audit went very smoothly very much due to the assistance that they mm-hmm. provided. And when the audit was over, they were quite thankful for what we came up with, and they felt that what we had recommended was very consistent to what they themselves saw as the way to go. So it gave them some assurance that their plans were are reasonable.
Excellent. Not surprising at all. I know that it's a huge undertaking to set up something like a backup type system. It's a large and it's a long time project, and there are a lot of finite details that go into that, and a lot of people probably wouldn't think about that, but it's pretty detailed, I know, from the experience of being part of that. I want to move on now to the agricultural side of things and your audit there. And Mr. Lapointe, I guess I'll go to you first. I believe this is a quote of yours. The department is not adequately managing its duty to audit. In other words, inspect facilities that process meat or slaughter animals for human consumption. That failure increases in public health risk associated with meat and meat products, and that was your comments at press time last week. The minister said last Friday morning, I heard him on CBC talking about the fact that your report was not accurate. Sort of interested, do you think that your report wasn't accurate? Did you make a mistake? You've had a week to think about it now. Do you feel that there's been, and I say that sarcastically, of course, do you feel that there's been some mistakes made? Or did you miss something? I'm sure you've heard the minister's comments. Mm-hmm. What's your thought on that?
We're always, quite open to the idea that, we do make mistakes in our reports because we're not, we're only human. But, there aren't in this case. And we mitigate that risk, of having an error in, or significant errors in our reports by going through a pretty pretty rigorous process with the audited department through the audit itself to have them verify the factual accuracy of our findings. And we do sit down with them all the way through, and especially near the end, and make sure that things don't creep in, and they do catch things. There's a reason for that kind of process. It is a form of quality assurance in a way, it was effective in this case. I think our report is accurate, and I think the conclusions we made are factual, and our recommendations, I think, are also effective in minimizing the risks to the public if they're implemented. I don't think the people in the department wouldn't disagree. They've indicated to us that they are supportive of the recommendations, in fact. So I'd expect that they would take action on it fairly quickly.
Was there anything during the audit, in response from the folks working in the department that would make you think that there were any mistakes made in this? I mean, you sound confident that you worked well with those people in the departments that you audited. They were very forthcoming in assisting you complete those tasks. There would be nothing in there to indicate to you that there was anything misrepresented. That may not be a very good word, but what I'm getting at is it would not indicate that you were making any mistakes or concluding any wrong evidence or reviewing any documents that weren't accurate and so on?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think the accuracy of a report is really an issue.
Thank you. Another quote, when it comes to the Auditor General's observations about the length of time between inspections at meat processing facilities, the minister told the media, I have to say, but I have to disagree with the minister, with you, sir, the Auditor General. Even our records indicate that someone would be there, at least try to be there, three times. What does he mean by that? Is there some misrepresentation? Is there something not clear in what you're saying and what the minister's saying?
Well, possibly it's a difference in interpretation of what's going on there. There was certainly no mention of such a policy three times a year or anything else while we were doing the audit. The policy that we were told was informal but was in place was that while a plant is operating, it should be it should have an inspector in every month. So we audited to see if that was happening and found, of course, in our findings that that was not happening as a general rule. And quite often there are cases of long periods of time without that. It may be that since this time they're reconsidering their policies. But at the time we conducted the audit, the informal policy, to the extent it existed, was once a month while a plant is in operation.
So I guess it doesn't matter in some respects because he says, disagreeing or otherwise, he still says that he agrees and states clearly he agrees that we will recommend or we will accept all the recommendations put forward by the Auditor General, his report in his office. So
that's correct. In spite of any comments we might have had or they might have had in the media since the report, the department has accepted the report and the recommendations and has indicated that they do intend to take action on it. So that, to my mind, is the important part of this,
right.
That the corrections be made to the system to improve it in the way we've suggested.
Given the significance of something like meat processing and, the risks are pretty high, this is a pretty serious thing when you find deficiencies in areas such as this. And do you, as Auditor General or your department staff, have an opinion of how much time it should take to implement something of this serious of a nature, Mr. LeBlanc?
I think it might be hard to say how long it takes.
I guess from an auditor's perspective and someone, you know, who's been in, done the work, spoke with staff, reviewed everything in what certainly is fair detail, is there something from your perspective that, you know, is 3 months, 6 months, a year, a month?
It might depend on the individual recommendation, but I'll ask Mr. Spicer to talk to that as well, having done the audit.
All right, thank you. I think, like Mr. Lapointe said earlier, most of the recommendations that we've made in this report are fairly easy to implement. They're process types of recommendations, so they really, you know, to put a time frame on them is a little bit difficult, but I don't see them as being very difficult things to do. When we come back in 2 years' time to look, to follow up on the status of the recommendations, and you know, I think that the 2 years should be plenty of time to do these things. And I think that, I mean, if you look at their recommendation, their response, as well as through our conversations with the department, I'm fairly confident that they'll have these done before that time period. So, I mean, a couple of them may be a little bit more difficult to do, but overall, they're not really, you know, they're process-orientated types of recommendations that they should be able to deal with fairly quickly.
Thank you, and it was interesting to hear you say that, because so we're looking at 2 years before you go back and have a look to say, okay, well, they've made the following changes and implemented the recommendations. Although food inspection is a fairly serious issue with very high risk, is 2 years in this particular case, and I realize maybe that's, you know, standard practice, but is 2 years in something as high risk as food inspection and food safety adequate time in the opinion of the Auditor General? And I leave that to you. I'm certainly no specialist in it, but I'm thinking about the seriousness of the issue. Is that adequate time before you go back and say, yeah, this looks okay?
Well, I think it's... I think from our point of view, our concern is to just follow, at least have a regular process to make sure, to go back to see whether things are done. As to lighting a fire under people adding more urgency to some recommendations, getting them done more quickly, my feeling is that that is government's job. But you know some improvements have been made on that kind of monitoring. I know that Treasury Board, for instance, is putting in a system of at least twice a year, you know, getting regular reports from departments on the status of these recommendations. And that's something we've recommended for a long time, and that is starting to happen now, so that the government itself can monitor progress on these things, and the deputies themselves, who are the ones who have a stake in this, are really, you know, as the management of the organization, are the ones who should be keeping an eye on that very issue, that higher priority and higher risk changes are made first. And so they have an opportunity to do that now with a new monitoring system.
Yeah, oversight is obviously going to be the key here, and I mean, quality assurance is number one in some areas, and maybe some non or lesser important items certainly can take a little more time and probably don't have to be monitored quite as often, but something as significant would have to be. Just a quick question. I'm probably getting close to my time, am I, Madam Chair? How much time do I have?
You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. I think I have time. There was I did hear a description from the minister, I think maybe in QP, when I asked him a question, and I certainly heard it in the media. With regards to the level of infraction, I heard examples along the lines of light bulbs and hinges. And if I recall, maybe hearing something more, and it could have been a media interview as well from you, that it was a little more significant at those levels. Those were a couple items that were mentioned, but it was more like the cleanliness of the machinery that was being operated versus maybe a light bulb or a hinge. And those levels didn't quite fit as significantly as they should have. You want to comment on that, Mr. Paul?
Yes, well, you know, we did find that there's not a lot of consistency in the way the three levels that they do have currently, and we did recommend they re-examine that as to how effective it is. But what's categorized as a 1, 2, or 3, one is inconsistent, and it always not doesn't seem to follow any kind of a system. We have examples, for instance, of... I was just looking at them here. At level one, which is minor and had no particular time frames for implementing that, there were, aside from, you know, light bulbs, there was a meat grinder that needed cleaning. That's fairly significant to my mind. Mm-hmm. There was a kill floor that was dirty. And in level two, we had freezer walls that needed cleaning, and in fact there was a product on the floor that needed to be picked up. And we had also, aside from some safety issues at level 3, a hoist that needed repairing immediately, and some of the cleaning of equipment in there too. So we found, for instance, cleaning of equipment in all three levels. So we couldn't get a good feel for what kind of significance you could place in any of the different levels in terms of the findings that are in there. That is why we recommended that they examine this and get some guidance, so that when you look at any particular level, whatever they may happen to be, that there's some consistency in what goes in those levels, and that there's some graduated process of enforcement as it becomes more serious as you go up to the top.
Thank you. Your time has elapsed now, so I would like to turn it over to the NDP caucus. You have 20 minutes, and it's Mr. Epstein.
Thank you very much, and Mr. LaPointe, thank you very much for your report. It addresses a number of important issues, a number of important topics, as usual, in the Auditor General's reports. I think turning to the topic of meat safety and the position of persons in care and what's happened with the Nunn Commission and the provisions for securing IT information, this is all very useful. And I wanted to thank you for having turned to those in such a useful way. The focus of my questions, however, will have to do with Chapter 5 and the attempt to audit the Canada-Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. I wanted to make it clear that we're very appreciative of all the work that your office does. And I am concerned, however, that the attempt to audit the CNSOPB was apparently not successful. And what I really want to try and find out is whether we can have a complete understanding of how it is that this process didn't go forward. Before we look at that in some detail, I wonder if you could explain what it is that was proposed to be done. That is, perhaps why it is that the CNSOPB was going to be looked at, what kinds of things you would have been looking for, anything about the background to it.
Yes, well, in fact, I'll ask Terry Spicer to address that, if you don't mind.
Sure. Mr. Spicer.
Thank you. The audit really originally started with contact from the Federal Auditor General's Office, the Environment, the Commissioner of the Environment and Sustainable Development, who this particular board came on their radar for something to audit. And I think everything that's happened with oil spills and stuff like that, it just seemed, I guess, that they wanted to look at this one and in Newfoundland as well. So they contacted us and to see if we would be interested in doing a sort of a joint type of an audit, and it certainly with the important things that this board does in the offshore, we said yes, this would be, you know, it would make sense for us to do some work there. So.
And just to be clear, this of course is a jointly constituted federal-provincial entity, isn't it?
That's correct.
And
yes.
There are mirror statutes that set it up with both the provincial and the federal government appointing people to the boards. That's right?
That's correct.
And the idea here is joint supervision of various aspects of the offshore with respect to petroleum product extraction. Is that right?
That's right.
And so they were going to look at the environmental aspects, to look at what? Health and safety?
Yeah, the original plan, and again, this was very early on. We were just in the survey stage of talking about this. The plan was that the federal OAG's office would look at the environment and perhaps governance, and we would take some of the other areas that are more specific to Nova Scotia, which would be offshore health and safety, the employment industrial benefits area, the licensing area, and those types of things. But again, we really were at a very early stages. We were talking about how we might do this, and these were the areas that we decided, well, if we were to go forward, these would be the logical areas that we would each look at.
In addition to the environment and health and safety and licensing, would there not be an additional ambit of authority over the payment of royalties? Does that come under the CNSOPB, and was that something that would have been looked at as well, or is that what you mean by licensing?
That's actually handled by the Department of Energy. The board has little to do with that, so I understand. And again, you know, we were early on here in the, so you know, I'm not familiar with everything that they do, but my understanding is that's really a Department of Energy area. So the licensing was when they put a parcel of land or area out for development, how to determine who is successful in getting that license and that type of stuff. That's the sort of the licensing area.
Okay. All right. I think that clears up some of the background. Is it fair to say then that when the federal Auditor General's office, your counterpart, came to you with the suggestion that the CNSOPB was an appropriate entity to look at, you agreed and were quite prepared to start your part of the audit? That is to say, you thought it was a worthwhile audit to do?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Right. And does it remain a worthwhile audit to do?
Mr.
Yes,
LaPointe.
Yes, it does. I would say it's still a worthwhile audit to conduct.
And the state of play at the moment is that your audit has been frustrated. Is that right?
I suppose you could characterize it like that. Yeah. So it's been rendered extremely difficult to do due to just simply a lack of information that would be available to us.
I'm sure it's impossible to do the audit without the information, but really what I wondered was, I think the word abandoned has sometimes been used, I'm not sure by whom, okay, to characterize the state of play. Do I take it that you haven't actually necessarily decided that you would never do this audit or you wouldn't do it, but that for the moment you're frustrated? Is that fair?
I'd characterize it as that we've stopped the attempt to conduct the audit. And made recommendations to government to change the legal structure around this board that would enable us to do the audit. And if that was the case, then we would look at going back in again.
So if the access to information issues were resolved, you could go back and conduct your audit?
The access disclosure to us, and also the undisputed ability to report what we find, which was really the core of the issue.
Yes, and just to be clear, that is the problem that the officials at the CNSOPB raised. It didn't seem from the documents that they were objecting to disclosure of the third party documents to you, but they were concerned, and the originators of the documents were concerned that you might in turn disclose some of those documents publicly. Is that the focus of the dispute?
Yes, the focus of the dispute is our reporting to the House after the audit and what could or could not be included in that report. And the particular information there that was the issue was any information that is provided by the operators to the board. They would say that they retain ownership of that information.
Is it the case that we don't actually know, or you don't actually know, what this information is, that is, even the general category of this information, simply because you didn't get far enough into the audit?
We don't know the details. We did provide a list of some information. In fact, maybe Terry could provide a little more detail on what that is, if you like. But we did ask for certain information that was relatively specific at the start of the audit.
Yes. It's general categories that I'm wondering about.
Okay. Well, we can. I mean, there's basically what we did was. We would have had. we would have had survey meetings with certain management there in the various areas just to get an idea of the types of what they do. So we would have asked for information related to health and safety, as an example, which may be include responses from operators, as an example, on an OH&S incident. That would be a type of an example of a document that we would want to see. So that's an example. I mean, I have a number of things we've asked for, some of which may become under the privilege, some of which would have been a board document. So there's that type of area. There's other things like licensing. We would have asked for license applications and those types of things if we were going to audit that area, we would need to know how that worked and that type of stuff. So,
okay.
So those are the types of things we would be asking for.
That's fine. Mr. LaPointe, I was curious about answers that you gave to my colleague from Preston a little earlier on when he was asking you about some of these points. He, for example, asked you why you couldn't go to court, and part of your answer was you said that Section 14, subsection 6 of your own statute was not applicable. And then you also said that court was not effective. Going to court was not effective to resolve the issues. And I have to say I was somewhat puzzled by this. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if I could start first by asking you if, when you encountered this resistance from the CNSOPB, you asserted any of the powers that you have under your own statute to the CNSOPB. Did you draw their attention to the different sections of your statute that would allow you access to documents?
I believe we were quite clear to the board that our belief is that the Nova Scotia Auditor General Act had provisions that provide us the right of access to the information. In spite of the existence of an Accord Act, that the Nova Scotia Auditor General Act did, in fact, give us the right to see any information that they have. And that was my belief, and it was pointed out to them during our discussions. But as for the, the specific discussions that went on later on about possible alternatives, we did not get into a discussion with them.
Their response seems to me to be a response that essentially says that their statute trumps your statute. That sounds to me very much like a legal opinion dispute. Doesn't it sound like that to you?
There are certainly, there are certainly disputes as to the applicability of the different laws, and in particular, a complexity is having federal legislation involved. And so that renders legal issues may seem at first to be simple, but in fact, anything that involves legal issues turns out is never as simple as it seems. Well, and the more you delve into these, the more complexities there are to any of the possible solutions.
Right. Well, law is my background, and I can certainly agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. But here's what I wonder. Did you obtain a legal opinion that advised you as to what your powers were in this situation faced with an auditable entity that was resisting your attempts to audit it?
Certainly, I've received advice from legal counsel so that I understood fully the issues.
And the advice that you received, did it tell you that your powers were insufficient?
It depends on what exactly that you're looking at.
You see, I would like to look at it. Do you happen to have your statute with you?
Yes, I do.
Great. So let's see if we can just look at some of the sections and see if we can figure out how this works, because on the face of it, I have to say, it looks to me as if your statute gives you a lot of very wide powers. And I would start with subsection 3 of section 11. And it says, in conducting an audit or performing any other duty or function under this act, the Auditor General has the same power to enforce the attendance of persons as witnesses and to compel them to give evidence and produce documents, and the same privileges and immunities as a judge of the Supreme Court. So When I read that, that basically says to me you could issue a subpoena to someone like an employee of the CNSOPB and say to them, come and bring your documents with you. Did you do that? Did you issue a subpoena?
No, I did not.
Is there some reason that you think that power might not
the power
mean
exists.
That?
I do, in fact, have very strong powers of subpoena, and I can compel evidence. So that I could, in fact, go to a court to have a subpoena issued. I could issue subpoenas, but I think what would happen
you,
is that...
You could issue a subpoena on your own.
Yes, but I think that any such action can, in fact, be challenged in the courts. And ultimately, the power is that if there's a subpoena, you understand, is not complied with, then the recourse that I have is to go to the courts to ensure compliance. So it is that is the beginning of a process of compelling evidence, and can in fact wind up challenged in the courts. I feel quite confident that I could, however, either through that means or through another means, through application to the court through 14.6 or some other. Eventually, after some cost and time, obtain the information.
And just to be clear, you haven't gone to court?
No, I have not.
No, that's right. Or started any proceedings?
I mean, because I'm clear that I think taking legal action in this case is inappropriate. I felt that the recourse is to enable oversight and audit of this organization through change of legislation.
When you answered the question earlier from the member for Preston, you said going to court wasn't effective. Now you're saying it's inappropriate. Is ineffective would have meant that the court couldn't give you the remedy that you asked for. Is ineffective mean something else? You didn't want to go to court?
We can play with words a lot, but what I'm trying to say is that I decided... At this point, the most effective means was to change the legislation. The effect of court action in this case is uncertain, and obtaining access to information has not, from the start, been the issue. Is the ability to report that information is the issue.
Which is a very focused question. Can you, once you obtain the evidence or information, include it in your report and disclose it to the House? That's a very focused legal question, isn't it?
And that is, in fact, the issue at stake.
Right. So everyone agrees that's the question. Doesn't that sound like the kind of question that we pay judges to answer?
I don't think that the question, when it comes down to it, is as simple as that, or that the answer on the reporting is as simple as it seems, keeping in mind that there's federal legislation involved. And what I feel confident about in any kind of in legal action is two things. One, that it could become costly and time-consuming, and two, that I can obtain access to the information. What I'm not confident on is the outcome of court action about disclosure of that information, because it becomes more complex.
Isn't it the case that if the CNSOPB can successfully say to you, we're not giving you information, that every other auditable entity can say the same thing? Wouldn't it therefore be very valuable to have a court ruling interpreting the legislation?
I'm not attempting to use an audit to obtain court rulings that would have for any purpose. That's not my objective here. My objective was to conduct an audit to provide information to the House
Absolutely.
On the operation of the board, not to get involved in lengthy court action for any purpose.
Yes. Were you advised that it would be lengthy? Is there any reason to think it would be lengthy?
That it could become so.
Let me suggest to you that where there's a focused legal question, the evidence goes to court and facts are not in dispute by way of affidavit, and then the courts just rule on the point of law, and that typically this is not a lengthy process. It's not like a trial where the credibility of witnesses has to be assessed. Was that pointed out to you by your legal counsel?
Well, perhaps. You know, I don't know if we can... I don't know if we can really, you know, get into the fine points of the different legal arguments here, because the fact just simply remains that my feeling was, after discussing it with my counsel, was that the potential uncertainty and risk of escalation getting into legal arguments with the board and the operators, that the outcome is uncertain. This is not a preferred route, and or a preferred use of our time or our budget.
So, if I can try and sum up, the situation seems to be that you think it's valuable to do this audit. Mm-hmm. It would be in the public interest to do the audit, but that you haven't asserted any of the powers that you have in your statute, and having been met with resistance, you haven't used the mechanism that's available in your statute, which is a court ruling to resolve points of law that are at issue between you and the auditable entity. Is that where we are?
The points of the sections of the Act that you're referring to as being empowering me to take a simple course of action to deal with the issue, I don't agree with. I don't think it's as simple as you say.
Do you think your powers are in effect are not clearly stated, and that you might lose?
There are powers that are clearly stated. They don't necessarily clearly state to what extent they apply to this situation. This situation is a little more complex than it would appear, and the provisions of my Act were never meant to deal with the particular situations we're dealing here with, and were never meant to deal, certainly, with federal legislation. And the minute you bring in the issue of federal legislation, then it does become more complex. So perhaps it's only a matter of opinion, but my opinion on this is that taking a legal recourse is not the preferred way, that it's simply not the best way to attempt to deal with this situation.
Mr. Epstein, the time has elapsed on those 20 minutes, so I just wanted the auditor to have the chance to finish his answer.
Thank you.
So I'm turning it over now, please, to Mr. Caldwell for the Liberal Caucus, and I'm looking at 16 minutes.
Thank you very much. I want to just ask a couple of questions about this Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. The previous member had some very distinct views on it, and I want to reiterate again that it appears that, at least in my estimation, and being a layman, not a lawyer or anything like that, or an auditor or anything like that, that it appears that you've taken the right approach on this, from the standpoint that if you get legislation changed, then there's not an issue in the future. And at the same time, if you go to court action, it could be a substantial cost to the taxpayers. Is that a good description of what the approach you've taken on this?
I believe it could be a substantial cost, not just a financial cost, but some substantial cost in our time and effort, and diverting us from other work that we could be doing. Yes.
Yes, and the and if the right legislation, whatever that may be, and you've described that already, was put in place, and you don't have that aggravation, and everybody is very clear on what the rules are past that once it's in place. Is that correct?
That's correct, I would point out as well that we have no disagreement with the board on that issue. The board does agree exactly with our recommendation and has so stated.
Well, that's great, and as I understand too, that the is the Department of Energy, and I want to make this very, very clear, that's responsible for this act, correct?
Yes, it is.
And would be the Minister of Energy that would be responsible?
Certainly for being responsible for the department, yes.
Yes. And so it's just an observation. I don't want an answer. It's strange that the Minister of Finance is answering questions on the behalf of the Minister of Energy. That's a little bit strange. So the As this goes through, again, you cleared up before that it had to be amendment to the Federal and Provincial Act, so that's something the government has to negotiate. Okay, that's really all the questions I want to ask on that. The back on the disaster preparedness that I didn't get a chance to ask about before, and I hope I don't repeat any of these questions, but I do just indicate so, and I'll look it up in the record. It seems like this is quite a concern that basically with all the problems that can happen today with computer systems and people hacking in and natural disasters and all the other things that could happen, most organizations that have a substantial amount of this type of sensitive information would have backup systems off-site and be well prepared for the event of a disaster. And we've seen the disaster that's happened in 9/11. Hopefully it's nothing like that ever happens again, but it could be something else that causes it. And hopefully never anything happens like that here. How serious could this possibly be? That's really the question I'd like to ask. How serious could it possibly be in the worst scenario?
I'll ask Alan Horgan to answer that question.
Mr. Horgan.
If we want to look at a worst-case scenario, which is probably a relatively low-risk but extremely impactful scenario, would be one that completely destroys the data center so that none of the equipment is repairable and the facilities itself perhaps would have to be rebuilt. And that same disaster impacted the place where the backup data is stored. If that were to occur, the government would have, it'd be very, very difficult to recover from that, because recovery is so dependent on being able to bring backup data to some, you know, new processors or new computers to become functional again.
In the backup, and I believe I heard this properly, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the backup, the place the material, the information is backed up, doesn't have the computer capability to really just click it back online and go. In the event, say, that where the equipment and everything is operating today and operating had a fire, and the equipment is just totally destroyed, which very easily could happen, and that could be a minor thing that causes a fire. But there's no actual equipment that they could put in place immediately to use that backup information. Is that correct, or am I wrong with that?
That is correct for the system supported by the Chief Information Office. As we noted, the system supported by computer information systems or corporate information systems, they do have a backup site in which they can completely switch operations over. So in one instance, it exists, but in the instance of the non-financial system supported by CIO, that is exactly the case.
And the non-financial system, what kind of information's on that?
Well, they would be running systems for, I would think, a majority of the departments in government. So things like the justice systems that supports the operation of the courts, the operations of the jails that feed information out to police forces. I would think of the land registries that record transactions for the purchase and sale of land, vital statistics, which keeps information on basically everyone in the province. Information used to provide income assistance payments to clients of community services. It's a substantial list.
That's pretty scary stuff, some of the stuff on that list. If it were to cease to be able to operate it, even though they had a backup. And the systems they have, I don't imagine these are systems you can replace in 24 hours. Must be quite complex systems that they would have to put in place, otherwise they would have them there and probably very expensive. Would that be accurate? Or
it gets a little technical there. If you have the backup computers, it's not that difficult to replicate a system. The technology they use, they can virtually almost photograph some hard drive disks that might contain various systems configured in different ways, and just take that photograph and reprint it on another hard drive somewhere else. So the actual moving around of systems is not that difficult, as long as those photographs, to use an analogy, are stored off-site. The key is to have the extra capacity in computers in which to bring those systems up again.
And they don't have that in the one area where they would have the vital statistics and register motor vehicles, police information, jail information. We've already seen some trouble with that. People being released that shouldn't have been released. That's what the system was supposed to be working. So I can't imagine what it would be like, the confusion, if that ever happened. But they don't have the actual system, the hardware system that they need to run this. Only thing they have is the backup. Is that correct? Off-site for that part of it?
Yes, so the only thing they have is the backup data as opposed to backup equipment. Now, I must say that the department is in full agreement that they need that kind of redundancy of having two data centers which basically have the same system so that if one goes down, the other can keep operating. And they're actually pursuing some different alternatives that way and looking for vendors to propose some solutions that may give them that that redundancy.
Well, that's very positive. But it is sort of startling to realize that, computers have all kinds of weird things happen to them as they work away. If they don't have the systems in place to back it up, there could be a lot of people in big, big trouble very, very quickly. I mean, outside the government, that especially social services checks or even the police, if they're working on things that are quite sensitive and lost some of that information, couldn't retrieve it for a while, would be pretty serious impact. And indeed, a fire, which happens all the time, could easily, that was an accident, actually, or a malfunctioning equipment or anything could cause a fire. So that the danger is real. It is real. And hopefully they'll get this sorted out pretty, pretty quickly. As this information, especially in the ones that doesn't have the equipment to handle it, is handled every day. This material is updated every day. How far behind is the backup system? Is it every day it's backed up, or is it once a week it's backed up, or is it backed up hourly or instantaneously?
We examined the backup process, and we were quite comfortable with the systems they use to back up their data. And as I mentioned before, they use a bit of a layered process where, certain backups are done on a very frequent basis. More comprehensive backups are done at maybe a weekly or longer period. And the backup processes they use seem to be very reasonable and what we'd expect of any data center.
Well, that's very positive. And they've indicated they're going to make the changes from your report. Have you received information back from them that said, yes, that we agree with your findings and that they're going to take corrective action?
That's correct.
Did they put a timeline on that?
They haven't. A lot of what they want to do will depend on on a new solution for the data center, which is, as I mentioned, is what they are seeking, proposals from vendors on right now. A lot of the stuff we recommend, they can't move forward on it until they've determined what this dual data center setup will look like, who's operating it, how is it configured. Once that is done, then they can get most of this done in short order, but they can't do it ahead of time. So I believe they've already gone out with the requests for expressions of interest and that was at the time of our audit, and where they are right now, I'm not too sure.
Well, it's reassuring that they're working on it.
They definitely are working on it.
Yeah, that's very positive, and I understand these things do take time. Hopefully, we don't have a problem in the meantime. That's usually what happens when the worst situation is there. That's when you have a problem. So let's hope that doesn't happen. I'm going to switch topics again. I'm going to go back to the meat inspection. We talked a bit about quality assurance. on this whole process. And as I say, I ran a quality assurance process that was very, very comprehensive, to the point that it included management decisions, actual component configuration of how components would be inspected, how they'd be manufactured, everything in the process. And it appears that that same sort of system would work very well with this meat processing. And it appears that all government, when I ask questions about quality assurance, there doesn't seem to be any anywhere in government. And that's one thing that would streamline government beyond anything else. It's very difficult to implement, but once it's there, your audits would be so much easier, because you'd be auditing whether this was done, and you just do some checkpoints and bang, it's done. Did you ever look at that in through government to see if there is any movement towards quality assurance?
We've never done a...
Mr. LaPointe?
Yes, we've never done a government-wide audit or a multi-department audit of that particular issue, but certainly we have run across it in the past and made similar kinds of recommendations in other programs. And I certainly would agree that a very high quality assurance system in a program like this or many others is almost can take the place of audit to a certain extent, because it deals with the issues on an ongoing basis and makes sure that or helps to make sure, at least, that problems don't arise, and when they do, that they're dealt with right away. So it's a very effective tool. It's one of the reasons we recommend it and have done so in other reports as well.
Has anybody implemented them that you've suggested in any form?
Kind of hard to say just off the top of my head, where we might have recommended something like this and it has been done.
It seems a consistent problem in government that either people aren't, there's no really quality assurance. When I say quality assurance, that if somebody's calling in with information, how that information is handled, how it should be handled, and indeed there's checkpoints to see if it is handled that way in every part of the government. It doesn't seem to be there. It doesn't seem to be there. And I'm the converted. When I first said, my customer said I had to have a quality assurance system, I said, what for? 2 years later, after I implemented, I found out what for. And it really reduced all the things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I was to a point that if a customer came in and found one problem with my system, one problem today, and a year later they found one more, I lost my quality assurance. And it took me 2 years to get it back. Canceled every contract I had, and I would have to go back again. That's how stringent it was. It was so easy to operate when it was in place. It was incredible. And this meat inspection would be even easier to do. And the same as we have all kinds of problems here with maintenance enforcement. They're supposedly not calling people back. A quality assurance system would fix that. Would fix it. And there would be requirements for each person, the things that the individuals would know what they have to do and know when they're doing it right. And their supervisors would know it's being done right and would have checkpoints to do all this. It seems to me that all these audits always come up with all kinds of things that could simply fix. Now, it's expensive to put in place. It takes a long time. But once it's there, it would save this government millions of dollars every year. Millions. And it just doesn't seem that there's any interest in doing anything like that. And as I say, I went through this. I lived through it. And now when someone says, want a quality assurance system, the answer is yes. And it can really, really save a lot of money. So maybe it's something when you're going through these processes. And I can sit down with you sometime and describe what I went through. And you don't need to be the level I was at because of doing military work. But it needs to be in place. And the more you look at it, it's a fantastic management tool as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Caldwell, but your time has elapsed, so I'd like to turn it over to Mr. McMaster, please, for the Conservative Party, 16 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my first question, I had a chance to read the
the letter from, if the return letter to you, to your office from the Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. Mm-hmm. And on the second page, and I have a couple of questions just to try to clarify the differences between your offices. On page two of the letter, and I'll just read a sentence from it, it says, the reality is that you would have been free to publish your findings and conclusions of the board's performance, but in doing so, you may have been unable to disclose some of the privileged information submitted by the operators, which would be the oil and gas companies. My question would be, could you have conducted the audit of privileged information, which would be proprietary information of those companies, and while not reporting specifics of that information, would you have been able to report that everything is okay with our offshore industry? Or could you, you know, if things weren't okay, could you come back and say government should review, you know, whether it be an issue of employee safety, something to do with the environment, or something to do with the royalty regime?
Well, it's highly doubtful that we could make meaningful comments if some of the information that we wanted to report involved some specifics. We could be so restricted that any of our comments would be meaningless. But we had no way of judging that ahead of time, of course, because we don't know what information out there might be a privilege according to the Accord Act and what might not, and to what extent it might impact the audit. But that particular comment in the letter, which I should note, was, by the way, was addressed to my staff, but really should have been addressed to me as the Auditor General. But the feeling seemed to be in that particular comment that we could have reported at will, just that there would have been some restrictions. Well, that of course is the whole point. And no restrictions on our reporting that was acceptable. And certainly, if we could not predict what that restriction would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, it would be, in fairness to your office, it would be pretty hard for you to do your job without being able to have access to the information and to be able to report on it.
Yes, certainly, without the access to it, of course, we really can't conduct an audit. But even with access, if we have restrictions on what we can report, it could, it is not appropriate, and two, could put us in a potentially untenable position of having information that we feel obliged to report to the House of Assembly, mm-hmm, because of the seriousness of it and being not able to report it.
Could you have been put in a position, had you conducted the research, conducted the audit, and had the information that you couldn't report on because, mm-hmm, it's because of restrictions, would you have then been put in the position where if there were issues around the safety of people working in the industry, possible environmental damage because maybe there's practices that are being carried out that are inappropriate, or maybe even that we're not getting our fair share of the royalties, would you then have been put in a position where instead of being able to report that to the legislature, you'd only be able to report it to the minister, which would in a way politicize your office in the sense that, yes, you can go to and audit these entities of government, but you have to report back into the center of government and let them address it without shining a light on it for Nova Scotians.
The core of that issue is that I could be in a position of having that kind of significant finding that needs to be acted on, to my mind, and yet perhaps being able to discuss it with the minister. But my reporting is to the House of Assembly, it would mean that I would not be able to report it as I'm supposed to do. And if the finding was significant enough and did perhaps, say, involve worker safety, the position is potentially untenable. And I would not place myself in that position.
Exactly. You know, if there's... if we look at royalties, if there's no audit by the Auditor General, how do we know for sure that we're getting our fair share of royalties?
I'll ask Mr. Spicer to speak to that one.
Mr. Spicer, please.
The royalty side of things is handled by the Department of Energy, so is outside of the board's responsibility. So I believe there is some audit work done on the royalty side of things. So now we didn't look at that as part of this audit, though.
Right. But I guess, and I respect that there would be within the Department of Energy, but I guess the purpose of the auditor's office is to be able to make sure that people working in government are doing their job to make sure that we're getting our fair share. So I guess as a backup, to ensure that everything is running as it should, that's the whole purpose of your office in that particular case. Would that not be the case?
Mr. LaPointe or...
Mr. Spicer. Yes.
Okay, very much.
It's possibly, but again, we haven't, I don't know, we haven't addressed that issue, so I don't know what limitations might be there mm-hmm. for us if we were to delve deeper into that area. I am aware that there is some audit work done by the Department of Energy on the royalty side. That's really all I really know about that area.
Okay, thank you. So, and I'll address this to Mr. LaPointe. The Minister of Finance believes that the impasse between surrounding this issue, if you'd be able to go into audit, to do a proper full audit of the Canada Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board, Minister of Finance believes that that impasse can be resolved in the Supreme Court. Why do you disagree with him?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I've stated earlier this morning... when I've looked at this and discussed the possibilities, you know, with my legal counsel and looked at the possibilities, and I've never felt that taking legal action on this was the best way to proceed, you know, for a number of reasons I discussed earlier. And I feel that to begin with, you know, legal action, they're a provincial agency, even though they're federal provincial. They are an agency of government, and court actions and legal disputes, you know, within government are really the not the preferred route to my mind. I don't want to get into these kinds of things if I don't have to. So I've asked the government to take the role of resolving the issue by reviewing the acts involved resolving, in effect, the potential dispute. Now, I should point out that the board, we in the board are in total agreement on this, and we don't want to get involved in court action and legal disputes. And if I can quote what the board had to say to this, they have said that the board agrees with the recommendations of the Auditor General to the Department of Energy, stating that the provincial government should evaluate the legislative framework under which the Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board operates and make appropriate changes with respect to disclosure of third-party information. In fact, they say the board has previously made a similar recommendation to both levels of government. So, in effect, we are asking the government to take the action that's necessary to make the changes and just make it possible for us both to work in harmony.
Okay. So... you know, it amazes me that the government would put up walls to that, and it seems that they're more interested in wanting this. I mean, they've come out and said they want it to be solved in court, which to me is more about trying to be clever than being decent. I don't think there should be any debate. I can't imagine there'd be any debate over getting to the bottom of making sure that people working in the oil and gas industry are safe. That environmental regulations are being complied with and the departments responsible for doing that work are on top of it. And for also to make sure that we're getting, of course, our fair shake of the royalties. They represent, I think, upwards of, at one time, they represented about 2% of provincial revenues. Has anybody given you any indication of why they would not welcome you to do your job and to be able to, I mean, I respect that, you know, those companies that are to protect the interests of the companies to come here, to keep to continue to attract oil and gas companies to come and do their exploration and their extraction of the resource here. We have to respect their competitive information, but surely there's a way without having to go to court to get around the notion that for your office to be able to do your job.
Well, the government's initial and I guess official response to this, in the which we printed on a report, was that they would in fact at least review the legislative framework, and the board as well has stated that they agree with the recommendation with the response of the government to review the issue and make appropriate changes. So that, as far as I know, that issue is not off the table, and that approach is not off the table. So I think it's still open for discussion.
So in other words, the legislation could be one way. If the legislation was changed, that would be a way of solving the impasse.
It certainly would, and I think we could assuming all parties were amenable to discussing this, I think we could all sit down and negotiate what those changes could be and find compromises that would provide the protections that companies need and provide us the access and the freedom to report that we need. I'm pretty sure that's all doable. Mm-hmm. How long it would take or how difficult the negotiations would be, I don't know. But then it resolves the issue with clarity and without dispute mm-hmm. permanently.
Mm-hmm. You had spoken with the minister about this. Was there anything specific that came out of those discussions?
No, we had a short discussion about it at a certain point, but nothing, as I say, it was short and put our positions forward and didn't say too much.
Did you specify the changes that could solve this through legislation?
No, I haven't made specific recommendations on the changes. I thought that would be a little presumptuous, but I think it needs to be examined and get all parties involved to put forward what they think should be done.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on to protection of persons in care.
Yes.
And one of the things that your report had concluded was that there was a need for an appeals process. So anybody who is in care of the province, mm-hmm. If something has happened to them, if they've been abused and they've reported it and it's been found, it's been decided that no, there has not been any abuse, there is no process right now for that person to go and make an appeal. So your office recommended that was necessary. Is that that's what you recommended? Could you make some comments on that?
Yes, I could. In fact, we did make that recommendation to what I must say was, and otherwise we concluded a very well-run program. But you know, we did have concerns given the potential the potential risk to individuals on this one if it doesn't run well. But I'll ask Ms. Coleman-Saad, who conducted the audit, to speak to that one.
Ms. Coleman-Saad? Thank you. So that is correct. Yes, there isn't currently an appeals process. Typically, I guess an allegation of abuse would come forward a lot of the times from someone other than an actual victim mm-hmm. That the abuse is alleged to have occurred towards. It's more instances of, say, a worker in a home or a family member or maybe the administrator of a facility that would make those, although certainly an individual would be free to allege an allegation. I just don't think that that's typically how they come forward. But in either instance, the complainant, if you will, whether it be an administrator or you know, potential victim of abuse, there isn't a formal process for them to go through and appeal if they don't agree with the outcome of that investigation.
Okay, are there not other departments in government where systems like the ones you've recommended, like the one you've recommended would be where the department could, say, copy a system somewhere else in government that would work instead of having to create one from scratch?
I think so, and I think even within the departments there would be some processes. For example, there's appeals processes within, say, home care at the Department of Health, and
And I think it's important to recognize here that we're not suggesting a really complex legal tribunal appeal board. We're suggesting just a simple administrative review process, really, within the departments where, you know, someone perhaps more senior that hasn't been involved at all in the whole complaint review process and outcome of the investigation takes a look to make sure that everything has been covered, that all sides have been considered, and that the outcome was appropriate. So it's really just a process for a second look, and it doesn't need to be, you know, really complicated and involve, you know, large boards that have to meet and involve legal proceedings and whatnot. Something simple could, I think, could deal with the recommendation.
Well, that makes sense, and it sounds very practical. I have one last question, because I think I've only got 30 seconds left. This is a bit of a technical one for the disaster response and the backup of information systems. We know that the amount of data must be massive, but also that the cost of storing data is cut in half every 2 years. Is there any time in the near future where backing up this amount of data online, I think they use the expression in the cloud, would be feasible, or is the data just too large?
I ask Mr. Horgan to speak to it.
I agree with the premises of what you state. Bandwidth, which is basically the amount of data you can send through lines, at any point of time, is expanding. Of course, the volume of data is expanding, but yes, I think that definitely the backing up of data, you know, in those ways to the so-called cloud, which is basically just massive clusters of data centers, is perhaps the future of operating data centers.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and your time's elapsed. I would like to return to Mr. Epstein for the NDP caucus, 16 minutes.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Lapointe, I'm going to continue with some questions and comments about the Chapter 5 materials about the CNSOPB. I really want to say first that I want you to be clear that I would really like you to audit the CNSOPB. It is our hope that you will audit the CNSOPB as you originally intended, and that you will have full access to all materials that you consider necessary for the completion of your audit. That's the position of the government. We're really trying to problem solve here. So that said, let's see if we can't maybe try and solve the problem. The first thing I wonder is whether the consultation you had with legal advisors is something you're prepared to show us. I have nothing but the most respect for solicitor-client privilege. Yeah. I'm not going to even remotely attempt to compel the release of it, but I was wondering if there's a written opinion, and if so, whether you're prepared to share it with us so that we can think about it.
Well, I know you'll understand if I say that in this case I'm going to stick with solicitor-client privilege.
Perfectly fine.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. Let's continue then, if we may, with our examination of the Act. Mm-hmm. We looked at one of the sections before in which I pointed out you had the powers of a judge of the Supreme Court, and you agreed that you hadn't attempted to use that power. Now if we turn, that was Section 11. Now if we turn to Section 12, what it says is that the Auditor General may require any person to provide evidence, testimony, or information under oath, and or provide documents respecting the matter under question, and may issue a notice requiring such attendance or evidence. And if you do that, and if the person fails to respond positively, you may apply to the Supreme Court, which may, in response to some an application of you, the Auditor General, quote, may commit the witness for contempt. Again, just to be clear, you haven't attempted to use the Section 12 powers either, is that right?
No, I have not.
Okay. Then if we look at Section 14, again, it puts a positive duty on any officer, employee, and agent of any auditable entity to forthwith provide the Auditor General any such information or explanations.
that you may require. And again, it says where the Auditor General and the auditable entity are unable to agree as to what records are privileged records, either party may make an application to the Supreme Court to determine the matter. And again, just to be clear, you haven't attempted to invoke any of the powers under Section 14, is that correct?
I've attempted to invoke 14.1.
You've asked for the material?
Naturally. And I pointed out the fact to them that it requires them to comply and forthwith provide the information. And that's as far as I've taken that.
Right. But you certainly haven't. The point, this is obvious. You haven't attempted to go to court to back that up.
No.
No, fine. Okay. Can we also agree that there are certain restrictions on your ability to disclose information that you do receive? I draw your attention to Section 15 mm-hmm. of your own Act. It does say that where matters are subject to solicitor-client privilege, litigation privilege, settlement privilege, or public interest immunity, even though such information is available to you to do your audit, you're not supposed to reveal it subsequently. So you do have a limitation in the statute. You're aware of that, I'm sure.
Yes, I am. Okay. In fact, write that provision.
Okay. But given all of that, is it your belief that you actually do have the power to conduct the audit of the CNSOPB? Now that you've thought about your statute, you've been met with resistance mm-hmm. by an auditable entity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it your view that, in fact, you do have the legal power to compel the information to come and do your audit?
My view is that I would, an attempt to compel, using any these or other legal means, that I would have a very high chance of success in compelling. If it was strictly a provincial agency, there would be, in fact, no dispute. But the fact is that it becomes then becomes a little more complex than being a federal provincial agency, and so that I'm not certain about come.
Okay. As you said earlier, there's always a little element of uncertainty on, mm-hmm. on any legal point,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you are. But you think you would have a good chance of success.
Yes, I would.
Okay, that's fine. And the barrier, again, is I think you pointed out, costs. And can I ask then about, well, the reason you said you didn't go to court is that you thought it would be lengthy, it would take up money in terms of expenditures and also use some of the time and effort of your office. Did I understand your reason?
That is one of the factors in my decision.
Are there other factors we should be aware of?
Yeah, the primary factor is that this does not deal with the issue of reporting to the House. That is the issue. The primary issue is not access to the information, and the board has acknowledged the fact that I have a right to audit. The issue is with my ability to then disclose any of this information in a report.
Right, that's the legal issue.
That is the issue.
That would go to court.
That is where we would potentially get into a... even if everything went perfectly, the issue could become a legal issue at the time of attempting to report to the House.
Well, in fact, it's a legal issue now because the CNSOPB has refused to give you the information unless you undertake not to report it to the
House. That's correct.
Yeah, so it's already a legal issue in play.
Issue now.
Yeah, okay. The issue then really is I'm trying to understand, which is the reluctance to go to court to try and deal with this, and instead of going to court, you're suggesting that the Accord Acts could be amended to get greater clarity. Is that
That is my recommendation and also the recommendation of the board.
The board being the CNSOPB?
Yes.
Fine. Now, can I point something out, which is, first, you do understand that because this is mirror image legislation, if a clarification of the Accord Acts was required, this would require action both by the Nova Scotia legislature and the federal parliament. You don't yes. understand that. Okay. This would in and of itself be time-consuming. Is that not correct?
Perhaps.
Okay. And in order to facilitate the audit that you contemplated, is it not also the case, let's assume that there's a problem with the legislation and that it does need clarification, wouldn't it have to be retroactive in order to clarify the information that is already in the hands of the CNSOPB could be released? Because normally legislation is what's called forward-looking. It takes effect when it is passed. So it would affect information in the hands of the board in the future. Wouldn't you also want to look at information from the past?
Okay, now you are, of course, bringing up legal points of which I have no knowledge, and okay. I can't answer that question.
Right. But you know, you could ask your lawyer about that. But no, and even if there were amendments to the Accord Acts, if there was still a dispute, wouldn't that end up in court? Isn't the court the place ultimately one goes to resolve this kind of question?
Presumably, the purpose of adjusting the Accord Act would be to eliminate the likelihood of dispute.
Yes, we try and write laws in the legislature all the time, and we strive for clarity as well as legality, and that doesn't stop lawsuits. They happen all the time.
Correct.
Because people think about these things. Again, I put it to you, that's what we pay judges for, is to resolve disputes.
Perhaps.
Okay.
But
earlier you suggested that there was an element of uncertainty, but also of cost. And I'm wondering if anyone had pointed out to you that, broadly speaking, there are two different kinds of lawsuit, one called an application and another called an action. And if I may just explain for a moment, an action is usually what people think of as a trial, where the facts are in dispute and credibility of witnesses has to be assessed by the judge, and it's a lot of it is about facts, and that's where things are protracted and there's discovery and it goes on and there are court hearings. And then there's an application in which the courts really are focused on points of law, and the facts are not usually in dispute, and witnesses usually don't have to appear to give testimony. It's all done by affidavit. I'm wondering if this difference had been pointed out, and wouldn't a dispute like this really be an application that is therefore shorter and more focused?
That's correct. It would be through application, not through action.
Do you have money in your budget that would allow you to take legal action, to retain counsel, or do you have legal counsel available to you?
I have legal counsel. There's no money in the budget for legal actions, and if money was required for it, it would come from some other part of the operation.
Okay. Or you could make a request, I think, to Treasury Board for money. Is that right?
Yes, it would come from the taxpayers in any case.
Yes, it would. Okay. I have to end with a plea to you, Mr. LaPointe, which is to perhaps reconsider this matter of whether it's more desirable to go to court than to try to seek legislative changes, leaving the entity unaudited. My plea to you really is to reconsider the possibility of using the powers that you do have in the statute and to reconsider the efficacy of the powers that the legislature here has given you, so that the good work of your office can go forward, so that the entity in this case can be audited. So I'll finish just with that request that perhaps you might want to just reconsider, think again, consult your legal counsel again, and if necessary, seek the funds. But thank you very much for answering the questions and for the discussion today. Thank you. Big
thank
help.
You. Thank you. And I will say that I am always open to other ideas, and I will keep this and your suggestions in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you. There are a few minutes left if you wanted them for the NDP caucus. No? We're fine. Mr. McKinnon?
Sure. Very quickly, if I could, disaster preparedness is really very important. And when we look at the Chief Information Office, when did the audit begin at the CIO?
I'll ask Mr. Horgan to answer that question.
I would say last winter.
Because this is somewhat important, because the Chief Information Office took over responsibility for disaster preparedness in the summer of 2010. So it was only a few months later that you began your audit, right?
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay. So can you outline for me what steps have been taken since 2010 in relationship to being better prepared readiness there with the CIO?
Since 2010?
Yes, yeah. Because it's my understanding that there are efforts being made, not just on your recommendations, but fundamental changes that were taking place since the CIO took over that role.
I'll ask Mr. Horgan to speak to it.
We did see progress being made while we were performing the audit. One thing that the CIO had prepared was a detailed plan for how they would become prepared. And of course, that's a logical first step for any large project, and this is a large project. We reviewed the plan that they had prepared. It was based on some best practices out of the UK. We thought the plan that they prepared for this was quite reasonable. We noticed that they were assigning responsibility specifically to certain individuals for the preparation of the plan, and that's a big part in making sure things get done, is assigning very clear responsibilities. They also mentioned to us that they were going to hire some additional people, which they would dedicate directly to this project. So all in all, we found that they definitely were taking it quite seriously.
Now, with the other system, the Department of Finance's Corporate Information System, the CIS, you were quite satisfied with the CIS recovery plan, and you also noted that the CIS regularly tests its emergency plans. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, the CIS does have a high level of commitment to emergency planning, and with that, we are assured that income assistance clients, businesses, public servants, and pensioners who rely on getting paid should feel comfortable with the government's plan on that front. Is that correct?
I would agree with that statement.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McKinnon, your time is up right now. Yes, it
Thank
is.
You.
Thank you. I'd like to leave a minute or so here if there's any final comments that you'd like to make, Mr. LaPointe, just about this fall's audit.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, I just want to say in closing that I and my office appreciate this committee's commitment to accountability in the Nova Scotia government, and we have appreciated the opportunity to discuss our report with you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. There is no committee business today. We have a meeting next week, which will be the Department of Education. So with that, if I had a motion to adjourn. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.